We are continuing our study of the book of Revelation. We'll be in chapter 13 tonight, and we'll study through chapter 13. As always, if we're going to properly understand the book, we need to remember the style of the book. It is apocalyptic language. It is written in signs and symbols, and that will be very evident in our study this evening of chapter 13. And we need to remember also who it was written to and why it was written. It was written to Christians who were suffering in the first century, and it concerned things that was going to happen to them, not things that was going to happen 2,000 years later to us. But if we can put ourselves in the shoes of the Christians who were suffering in the first century, it will help us to better understand the message in the book of Revelation. That's especially true with chapters 12 and 13. These Christians in Asia Minor were suffering terribly for their faith. They were losing their property. They were losing their lives. And naturally, they would have been asking the question, why? Why is this happening? In chapters 12 and 13, the Holy Spirit pulls back the curtain and allows them to see things that are happening in the spiritual realm. They are suffering on earth because of what's happening in the spiritual realm. In chapter 12, we were introduced to the dragon. Who was the dragon? Satan was the dragon. And Satan made war with the angels of heaven. The angels of heaven prevailed, and Satan was cast down to the earth. He and his angels were, and so it was on the earth that he was confined, and so he made war with the servants of God upon the earth. And that's why these Christians were suffering. They had a target painted on them. Satan had singled them out for as targets of his wrath. When we get into chapter 13, there are two more, if we could use this phrase, there are two more players that are introduced. There are two beasts that are mentioned here in chapter 13, and we're going to look at these two beasts, and we're going to look at their identity as we go down through, and it will help to further answer the question, why were these Christians suffering for their faith? Let's start here in verses 1 and 2. John says, "Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his horns 10 crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name." Now, John says that he saw a beast coming up out of the sea. In chapter 11, we're going to see the second beast introduced, and this beast comes up out of the earth. And so here's how the two are distinguished from one another. But here this beast is coming out of the sea. There are some commentators and scholars who suggest that the sea refers to the sea of humanity. And this beast, whoever he is, whatever he represents, it comes from a human origin. It comes from man. I believe there's a better understanding of this when you contrast the beast that comes from the sea or out of the sea with the beast that comes from the earth in verse 11. When we say that a product was made overseas, what do we mean? It's made in another country. It's foreign to us. It's come from overseas. Perhaps that's the idea here. This beast is foreign to those on Asia Minor. Those were the initial recipients of the book of Revelation, the 7 churches of Asia Minor. And here's a beast that did not originate with them, but came from somewhere else. And then notice how he is described. This is apocalyptic language to a T. 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his horns 10 crowns. That's similar to how the dragon was described in chapter 12. So picture, remember, we've been saying, paint this picture in your mind. Picture this beast coming up out of the sea, coming out up out of the water. 7 heads, 10 horns, the 10 crowns on his head. And on his heads, a blasphemous name. Verse 2, there's a further description. "Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion." Now try to picture this. So obviously this is symbolic. This is figurative because there's no beast that would look like this or could be described in this way. Who is this beast? Well, You take these two verses, you look, the seven heads would have to do, the seven being a number of perfection, head being where the intellect is at, where the mind is. So this beast has the intellect. 10 horns, horn is strength. 10 is completeness, so complete or perfect strength. A crown represents authority. You look down here, this dragon gave this beast his power, his throne. Notice he's sitting on a throne and reigning, isn't he? And great authority. Who is this beast? Well, earlier here in verse 2, it's described as a leopard, as a bear, as a lion. You go back to Daniel chapter 7 and read there in Daniel chapter 7 of the beast that Daniel saw coming up out of the sea, and it has these same figures, and a study of Daniel chapter 7 has reference to the Roman Empire. So here we have a description of Rome, in particular, I believe, the Roman Emperor. I believe that's who the beast from the sea is. He's the Roman Emperor. And that would make sense. He's from the sea. He's from Rome. He's not from Asia Minor. He's from Rome. But he has this power. And also notice, not just the power and the throne and the authority, but on his head's a blasphemous name. What did we say that some of the Caesars were demanding from the citizens? They were demanding to be addressed and worshipped as God. For a man to take on anything that belongs only to God is blasphemous. Remember the charge that Jesus was charged with in the trial by Caiaphas on the night to which he was betrayed. The charge that was laid to him was blasphemy. He said that he was the Son of God. That was blasphemy for him to say he was the Son of God, except for the fact that he was. Here comes Caesar saying that he is God and to be worshipped as God, that's blasphemous. So you look at these two verses, and what we see here is Caesar. We see the Roman Emperor. He is the beast that comes out of the sea. Verse 3 says, "And I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world marveled and followed the beast." So they worship the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worship the beast, saying, "Who's like the beast, and who is able to make war with him?" This head, one of the heads had been mortally wounded, and this deadly wound was healed. People get into this text, and we've got seven heads here, and one's been wounded, and who's the other seven? And we try to make this a succession of people or certain people. Look at the big picture. Again, as we're looking at Revelation, look at the big picture. Here the representation is a head has been mortally wounded. This thing ought to be dead. And it's not. It's still alive. And what's the message? The power behind Rome is so strong, no one can stop it. That's the idea. The power behind this beast is so strong, and who's giving the beast its power? It's not God, it's the dragon. And who do we say the dragon was? Satan. Satan is giving this beast its power. The only one who can stop it is going to be God himself. There are some who like to suggest or even insist that this head that was mortally wounded represents Nero. Nero was the first Caesar to persecute Christians, and then when Domitian comes and does it again, it's as if Nero has been resurrected, that he has come back. But I think a better understanding of this is a political power that man cannot stop, and Satan is using it to oppose Christians. And that's the idea here. No one can stop this. And because no one can stop them, who's able to make war with him? Who's able to defeat him? At that time, Rome was the world power. And if you wanted to exist and coexist with Rome, you supported Rome. You went along with Rome. You did not oppose Rome. And so here's this beast. It has all this power, and it has all this praise from mankind. Verse 5 says, "And he was given a mouth, speaking great things and blasphemies. And he was given authority to continue for 42 months. Then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. So this beast has been given a mouth. He's been given the power, the ability to speak. And what does he speak? He speaks blasphemies. He speaks against God. Verse 6 says that he opens his mouth in blasphemy against God. Not only does he have blasphemies because he is wanting to be worshipped as a god, but in opposing Christianity, he blasphemes God himself. Blasphemes God, blasphemes his name. Well, to blaspheme or to speak against the name of God represents everything that's connected with God. And so when he blasphemes the name of God, he blasphemes everything connected with God. Blasphemes his tabernacle. A tabernacle is a dwelling place. If we're accepting the late date, and we are, the temple in Jerusalem has been destroyed. So this isn't talking about the temple. But Ephesians chapter 2, verses 20 and 21 indicates that the church is the temple or the tabernacle of God. And so here he is speaking blasphemies against the church. What's Rome trying to do? Extinguish Christianity. Speaking blasphemies against the church and those who dwell in heaven, whether it be angels or whether it be saints who have gone on. The beast has the authority to speak blasphemies against God and the things of God. And notice the time frame in verse 5. This is going to help us. At least I think it will help us. It certainly would have helped the Christians in the first century. His authority continues for 42 months. 42 months is quite a span of time, but notice it is a identified span of time. It will come to an end. And that's the idea here, is that this persecution exists and it's going to continue to exist, but it's not going to last forever. It will come to an end. This same time frame has been found in the previous chapters we studied. In chapter 11, verses 2 and 3, we see that the court of the temple, that it was going to be tread, the holy city was going to be tread underfoot by the Gentiles for 42 months, that same time period. The two witnesses, they were going to prophesy in verse 3 for 1,260 days. That's the same time period. That equals 42 months. In chapter 12 and verse 6, the woman fled into the wilderness where she has a place prepared by God that they should feed her there 1,260 days. Again, the same time period. Down in verse 14, but the woman was given two wings of a great eagle that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished for a time, times, and half a time. That's 3.5 years. That's equivalent to 42 months. That's equivalent to all of those days. It's all the same period of time. And so here, this same time period has been mentioned 4 times in 3 chapters. This is a message given to these Christians in the first century. Yes, the persecution exists. It's going to continue, but it's not going to last forever. It is confined to a fixed amount of time. And I believe that fixed amount of time represents just how long the Roman Empire was going to continue to last. And of course, it wasn't 3.5 years. It was longer than that, but still, it was a determined length of time, and it would be over. Verse 7 says, it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. So notice, it's not going to get better. It's going to get worse. This beast that's coming up out of the sea, this emperor of Rome and the authority of the Roman Empire has been given the authority to make war with the saints and to overcome, to defeat them. Authority was given to him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. Remember, Rome was a world empire. They weren't just one little bitty country in Europe. They were a world empire. The Roman emperor had authority over everyone. Verse 8, all who dwell on the earth will worship him whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. Remember verse 8. It's going to come into play when we get down to the end of this chapter. Now, those who dwell on the earth worship him. The unregenerate, as some call them, those who are not Christians, they worship the emperor. Think about it. If you're a pagan, you already worship multiple gods. What's the big deal of worshiping one more? You mean I've got, in order to live, in order to keep my job, in order to keep my life, I've got to say that Caesar is God? No problem. For the rank and file of the Roman Empire? No problem. I can call Caesar God. All who dwell on the earth worship him. They worship him to escape the sword. It's not a big deal to them. But those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life and who want to stay in the Lamb's Book of Life, they don't worship him. They don't call Caesar God. And so here we see a contrast. There are those whose names are written in the Book of Life and will stay in the Book of Life, they don't worship this beast. The rest worship him. I kind of tucked that away. We'll come back to that idea when we get down to the end of this chapter. Notice here the authority that this beast has, and the power that he uses over his kingdom in getting men to worship him. Now, verse 9, if anyone has an ear, let him hear. You remember our Lord saying that? Numerous times Jesus would say that in his teaching and in his preaching. He who has an ear, let him hear. Every church, every letter that was written to the seven churches in chapters 2 and 3 ended with this admonition. He who has an ear, hear what the Spirit says to the churches. So, as these Christians in the first century were hearing the book of Revelation being read and came down to this passage, anyone has an ear, let him hear, they tuned in. They listened very carefully to what was coming next. He who leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. What's going to happen to the people in power who lead others into captivity? What's ultimately going to happen to them? They will go into captivity. And the one that kills someone else with the sword, what's ultimately going to happen to him? He will be killed with the sword. What was happening to Christians in the first century? Well, people who had the authority of Rome behind them would tell them, you deny Christ and confess Caesar as Lord, or here's the sword, and I'm cutting your head off. Or even worse. In the first century, Christians were being led into captivity, so to say. They weren't free to worship, as God had said. In the first century, Christians were suffering death. He who has an ear, let him hear. What's going to happen to those who are persecuting them? They are going to come to an end themselves. They are going to come to an end. Should Christians pick up the sword to fight against Rome? No. He who picks up the sword is going to be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. Here's what's going to get the Christians through this time. No, you're not going to be delivered from this time of persecution. You're going to have to live through it. But here's what will get you through. Knowing that those who are persecuting you and those who may even kill you aren't going to go unpunished. They are going to be punished. Rome is eventually going to fall. They will have to answer for what they've done. I believe this corresponds back to chapter 6. In chapter 6, we read about the breaking of the seven seals. And when the fifth seal was open, John saw an altar, and the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for their testimony were down underneath that altar. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, how long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? Well, chapter 13 and verse 10 says it's going to happen. It will happen. So you be patient, and you allow your faith that God is going to take care of this situation. You allow your faith to see you through this time. But you don't worship the beast. And you don't give up your faith. You keep your name written in the Lamb's Book of Life. And that's the message that would have been given to the Christians through the first half of this chapter, looking at that first beast, the beast that came up out of the sea. Well, now we go on to the second beast. The rest of the chapter is devoted to this second beast Verse 11 says, "Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth." Now again, remember, in your mind, paint the picture of what John sees here. Here's a beast that's coming up out of the earth. We can see something coming up out of the sea, but how do we see it? How does something come up out of the earth? Here's this beast that comes up out of the earth. Now remember, if coming up out of the sea meant that it was a foreigner, something that came from another country, what does it mean if it came up out of the earth? Something from within, or something that is here. Something that is from us. Something that we're familiar with. That's the idea. The first beast is from far away. Rome. The Roman Emperor. This second beast is coming up from the earth. It is something that is from them. Something that is familiar to them. He had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. Now remember the way that first beast was described. He had seven heads and ten horns, and his horns had ten crowns. The first beast was described as something that was horrific. The second beast is described as what? A lamb. So notice the second beast is something that is familiar and something that is appears to be harmless. So notice that distinction between the two. The first beast is ferocious. The second beast is, we're familiar with this. We're okay with this. This is the idea. Has two horns, not ten, but two horns like a lamb. Spoke like a dragon. Who is the dragon? Satan. So this beast that's from the earth is Satan's mouthpiece. He speaks what Satan wants him to speak. Verse 12, and he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence. Notice there's a connection here between the first beast and the second beast. The second beast, he exercises all the authority of the first beast. Whoever this second beast, whatever this second beast is, has the authority of Rome behind it. Has the authority of the Roman Emperor behind it. So he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence, and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to do what? To worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. So the second beast, he's familiar. He's a lot more friendly looking, a lot more acceptable than the first beast. He's a mouthpiece for the dragon. He has the authority of the first beast, and his job is to get people to worship the first beast. The second beast in chapter 13 is the religion of emperor worship itself. It's the emperor cult, or it's the enforcement of emperor worship. That's what the second beast is. As a matter of fact, in the rest of the book of Revelation, the second beast is referred to as the false prophet. In the rest of the book of Revelation, you read about the beast and the false prophet. That's in chapter 16, chapter 19, and chapter 20. So he's the false prophet. He is the religion that's wrapped around the emperor wanting to be worshipped. Or put it this way, whenever you have a dictator, you've got propaganda that goes around him, right? You've got the propaganda machine that goes along with any politician or goes along with any governing leader. Here's the propaganda machine. Here is the enforcement of emperor worship. That's what the second beast is. In verses 13 and 14, he performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. Now, remember, this is apocalyptic. Did the priest who were in the temples of the emperor, the Caesars, did they really perform these signs? No. What this has reference to really is right here in verse 14. He deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs. He deceives. He says the things he needs to say in order to get the people to do what the emperor wants them to do. So he deceives those who dwell on the earth. And by the way, he speaks like a dragon. And we were told that the dragon is Satan. And what does Satan do? Satan is the father of lies. Satan is the father of lies. So he speaks like the dragon. He lies like the devil. He deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. So here is emperor worship. Here's the enforcement of emperor worship. And what does he do? He tells them to make an image to the beast. How many of us can look on the internet or can look in history books or visit museums and see statues of the emperors that were made in the first century and successive centuries? These images were made. Also, there were temples that were built throughout the Roman Empire that were built to glorify the Caesars and to facilitate their worship as gods. Remember that the book of Revelation was written initially to Christians who were in Asia Minor. Well, the first three churches that were addressed, the first three cities, all had temples that were dedicated to the worship of Roman emperors. The city of Ephesus, the city of Smyrna, and the city of Pergamos all had these temples that had these images erected in them, and they were centers of Caesar worship. And it was in those places where Christians were especially compelled to worship Caesar as God. And as we went through those seven churches, we noted that the church in Smyrna and the church in Pergamos was especially persecuted by Rome, especially persecuted by those who were enforcing Caesar worship. So here, again, as we look through, we see that that this was the enforcement of Caesar worship. Verse 15, he was granted to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as who would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. The second beast, that is emperor worship, that religion was granted power to give breath to the image, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many who not worship. Let's look here about the breath, that the image was given breath and that it should speak. Some commentators, as I was reading and studying, suggested that in these temples where the emperors were worshipped, that the priest or the officiates would use hallucinogenic drugs to get the people there to start seeing things and thinking that that statue was actually talking. Others suggested that the mouth of the statue was rigged in such a way that it could be moved. Again, we're in a book of signs and symbols. Think about this. If this second beast, if those who were enforcing Caesar worship were exercising the authority of the emperor himself, wherever they were, the emperor by extension was there. Whenever they spoke, the emperor was speaking. And so by their very presence and by their very voice, the emperor was speaking through them. And that's what's happening here. Wherever this practice was enforced, that first beast was there. The emperor was there. And they were causing him to speak. They were causing his voice to be heard. But notice what else they were doing. When this religious practice was enforced, what happened to those who did not comply with it? What happened to those who did not worship the beast? They were killed. That's exactly what was happening in the first century and the centuries afterwards. As a matter of fact, we've already read in Revelation chapter 2 that one martyr is named by name. Antipas is named already. There's already been one who's lost his life for his testimony of Jesus Christ. And so as emperor worship was being imposed, as it was being enforced, Christians who refused to deny Christ and confess Caesar as Lord, they were being killed. They were being killed by the authority of the Roman emperor, but they were being killed because this worship was being enforced by what's identified as the second beast or the officiates at the temples of the emperors. Verse 16 says, he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. And here we get caught up, and we're going to spend some time talking about this mark of the beast, or the number of the beast. And here he causes them to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads. There are some who suggested that this was a tattoo mark. And apparently, historians say that that was a practice at the time, that it wasn't uncommon for someone who was devoted to the worship of a particular god to tattoo the name or the mark of that god on their body somewhere. But I believe there's a better understanding of this, especially when you look at the fact that they could not buy and they could not sell unless they had the mark of the beast. Remember in our introduction, when we talked about emperor worship, and we pointed out the fact that this cult, or this practice of emperor worship, once a year, everyone in the empire was required to go into a temple and to make this sacrifice unto Caesar. Burn a pinch of incense and say that Caesar was Lord and God. And when he did so, the officiant at the temple would give him a certificate, would put down his name, put down the date, and put down the fact that he has offered up the sufficient sacrifice to Caesar for this year. And that certificate gave him the freedom to engage in commerce for that year. It gave him the ability to have a job and to engage in commerce. If a Christian refused to go into the temples to the emperors and burn that pitch of incense, and they didn't have that certificate, if they lived in places like Ephesus and Smyrna and Pergamos, they starved because they didn't have a job and they couldn't go to the marketplace to buy or to sell. And so this was a great hardship on them. I believe that's what the mark of the beast is, or the mark on their right hand or their forehead. Not a physical mark, but I believe it had to do with that certificate that was given out there at the temples where these emperors were worshipped, and that was especially enforced in some of the cities there in Asia Minor. Now this next screen, what I've done is I've taken verse 17 and I've included it on the next screen, and we'll finish out the chapter here. That no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. This is similar to verse 9. He who has an ear, let him hear. Here's wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a, what? A man. Not the number of a god, it's the number of a man. His number is what? 666. Ever heard that number before? We hear that number all the time, especially from premillennialists and others that get all excited about end times and things of that nature. We've got 666. Kind of like 13. You know, the hospital doesn't have a 13th floor. Hotels don't have a 13th floor. And people want to avoid the number 666. Just this last week, I think I was at an airport, and I went to buy some things, and it rang up to $6.66. And the cashier looked at me like, please buy something else. Didn't even want to say what the amount was. Just, please buy something else. And I didn't. I made them give me change. That's all that I wanted to get. There are people that get worked up with this number, 666. This number, the mark of the beast, and it says, here's wisdom, let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast. And what a lot of people through history have done is they've tried to find people who fit that number. And instead of calculating the number of the beast, identifying that the beast is 666, they try to take the number 666 and go backwards and try to attach it to someone. In the first and second century, it was Nero. They tried to attach it to the Emperor Nero. There have been some who have insisted that it is the Pope of the Catholic Church. And corresponding to that, there are some who insisted that it was Martin Luther and the Reformers of the Protestant Reformation. So they go back and forth with that one, as you would expect. Napoleon was the beast, 666. Hitler, Saddam Hussein, Ronald Reagan. Any of you remember that? Ronald Wilson Reagan, each name in his name had six letters, and so there he was the beast. He was the Antichrist. He was the beast. And so a lot of people have made a lot of money speculating who this beast is with this number 666. Let's remember, as we're studying the book of Revelation, let's not forget the first rule, the style of the book. It's apocalyptic. It's symbolic. And we've already pointed out the fact that numbers mean things. What does the number 7 represent? You remember? Perfection. Divine perfection. That's the idea behind the number 7. Divine perfection. The number 6 is one less than the number 7. The number 6 is the number of a man. Man is always going to be less than God. And every effort of man is always going to be less than perfection. What's the number of this beast that everyone in the world is running to worship? And running to get that mark to identify that they belong to that beast. What is his number? His number is less than perfect. Here's the emperor who says that he is a god and he is to be worshipped as a god. But what is he? He's a man. He's a mere man. He's not a god. His number is 666. The understanding here is not that it's 666. But it's 666. That'd be like your child or grandchild bringing home a report card, and in math he got F. He failed repeatedly. That's the idea behind 666. Failure, failure, failure. Now, to the Christians of the first century, he didn't look like a failure. It looked like he was achieving. It looked like he had this power. But let him who has wisdom hear. Here is wisdom. He's really a failure. He only has authority for so long. And then that authority is going to be taken away, and he's going to be led into captivity, and he's going to die by the sword because he's nothing but a man. And he's going to fail. And those who have bowed down to worship him have identified themselves as belonging to him. They have received the mark of the beast, and they are going to fail with him. But those who have refused to bow down and worship him, their names are going to be written where? In the Lamb's Book of Life. And so that was the message to the Christians in the first century in Revelation chapter 13. Yes, there is a great power that's being exerted. And there is a great temptation for you to spare your life by denying Christ and calling Caesar Lord. But look at the big picture. Look at what you're really giving up. You're giving up your home in heaven for eternity in order to align yourself with one who is a failure, failure, failure. That's the idea behind the number 666. And the mark of the beast is not a literal mark on someone like it's made out to be in the movies. It's a spiritual identification. Just like chapter 7 in verse 3 talked about God sealing His servants on their foreheads. Spiritually speaking, we either belong to Satan or to God. Well, those who belong to Satan have the mark of the beast. Those who belong to God have the seal of God on their foreheads. A literal physical mark? No. It's a spiritual identification. But people still get all caught up with this number 666. They try to avoid it when it comes up on the cash register. Or I related this afternoon, a friend of mine in high school told me that they got a call from a preacher one time telling them they needed to change their phone number because the last three numbers in their phone number was 666. And they had the devil's phone number and they needed to change their phone number. People get all caught up on this number 666, what does it mean? It means failure, failure, failure. And the Christians weren't to follow one who was a failure. The Christians needed to remain faithful so that their names would be written, would remain written in the Lamb's Book of Life. That's all I've prepared for this chapter. We've got about a minute. Yep, and that same idea is found here. You know, don't get pressured into following after this emperor. He is just a man. That's right. All right. Sunday morning, chapter 14. Appreciate everyone's attention. Thank you very much.